My loves, I don't know if you're like me or many of my friends or a lot of the people that I know, but listen, do you have a cabinet in your kitchen that's packed with supplements and all these amazing things? They're all there to support your overall health, to boost your gut, to boost your vitality, but you ended up being like too overwhelmed to even like look at it and create a routine with them, that you're like just ended up skipping taking your supplements. I've been there too, honey. And this is why I want to take a moment to share an incredible discovery with you, my darling. It's called AG1. And let me tell you, it's been a game changer for me. And how I noticed that it was a big game changer for me was when me and my dad were doing that grief walk from friends through Spain. And I got to tell you, the food was delicious, but it wasn't the best for my gut. But how I kept the gut going, how I kept boosting my vitality throughout the walk was every morning I would put a packet of the AG1 into a water bottle and I would shake it up and I would drink it. Even my dad, who's always like, "Here, Dad, here, this is good for you." He's like, "No, thanks." And granted, you know, the homie's got, you know, he's doing really well health-wise. But he's always like, "Nope." But with this, with AG1, he was like, "Okay, give me some." And he would take it. And it's amazing when you take something, with routine and you start to see the results. It's like, okay, fine. I found my thing. Especially because it's just one serving that has the most straightforward way and simplest way for you to get your vitamins and your nutrients and your minerals and your prebiotics and probiotics. And honestly, why take a bunch of different things when you can just get all of it in one scoop of this delicious magic AG1 powder into a glass of water or into the beautiful water bottle that you get? This is how I start my days, honey. And honestly, if you're a traveler, they also will send you. You could also get the AG1 travel packs, and they're amazing. And every time I have a friend that comes over to the house, I'm always like, "Here, take a couple of these and try it out for yourself, you know?" And I want to share an amazing, exclusive, delicious offer with you today. If you want to take ownership of your health, then try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/sa. So that's drinkag1.com/sa. You got that? And if you don't, go to the show notes. It's there. And cheers to your health and your vitality. What's up? And welcome back to the Spiritually Sassy Show, where we are redefining what it means to be spiritual in the modern world. I'm your host, Sade Simon, and I'm so grateful that you're here. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Now let's talk about today's guest. This legend is someone that I met at Peggy Callahan's holiday party. Peggy is the director of the newest documentary film, the Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who has recently passed, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. They both got together to create this, a book called The Book of Joy. And then that book became a documentary called Mission Joy. And Peggy is the director of the documentary film. Peggy is also the person who invited me to go meet the Dalai Lama in India a few months ago and also participate in anti-slavery work. She runs the organization called Voices for Freedom, which they've been doing anti-slavery work for a very long time. Anyways, that trip blew my mind, cracked my heart open in a variety of different ways. I was so like feeling hopeless by the situation, but also so deeply inspired. More on that to come. Now, let's talk about today's guest. I'm at Peggy's party. Peggy invited me. I was like, "Oh my God, I'm going to this party. There are going to be all these people that I'm so intimidated by." I was trying to get someone to go with me. No one could come. So I had to go by myself, honey. And I went by myself and then ended up having so much fun. Ended up meeting so many amazing people. And one of the people that I met is the legend that we get to have on the show today. Lara Love Hardin. Lara Love Harding. Harden is her last name. She's the president and founder of True Literary. She has an MFA in creative writing and is a four-time New York Times bestselling collaborative writer, including the number one New York Times bestseller, Designing Your Life. And 2018 Oprah Book Club pick, The Sun Does Shine, which she co-authored with Anthony Ray Hinton. Her memoir, which is what we mostly talk about in today's podcast, is The Many Lives of Mama Love, which was published in August 2023 and is being adapted as a television series. It chronicles her slide from soccer mom to opioid addict to jailhouse shock collar and the decades spent rebuilding her life. Get into this episode and have so much fun, because it's fun and it's deep and it's so heartfelt. It really like tickled my heart so much. Okay, love you, Mina. Enjoy. I am so honored and excited that you are talking to us today, given how life is serving you the fucking hot tea right now. Oh my God. Thank you for being in the show, my darling. Lara Love, also known as Mama Love. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's so good to see your face. I cheered up instantly seeing your face.
Oh, thank you, my love. And as I shared in the introduction, we met at a holiday party and I was immediately like, first I was intimidated by you. I was like, ooh, who is this woman? So powerful, so gorgeous. And you just like, you know, you have worked with and are in rooms with the people that I have been like, you know, so profoundly inspired, like His Holiness, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, like, you know, all these folks, I have been looking up to them and reading their work and so inspired. And you're just like, that's right, honey. That's what I've been up to. And I'm just like, yes, I fucking love you. And then you really moved me when I didn't see you at the party for maybe an hour and you came back and you showed me your phone. And like, I just ordered your book. I was like, I had to like take a moment. I was like, that powerful motherfucking bitch right there, who I'm inspired by, goes away, does her thing at the party, and comes back and shows me that she bought my book. Whoa. The karma of that, it just healed something in me.
Really?
Mama Love, yes. I didn't tell you at the party, but I wanted to tell you on the record. That's like, it's amazing when you have somebody that you're inspired by, that you're intimidated by, you know, share that they also think you're cool. It's such a nice thing to be seen, you know, on an equal playing field. So anyways, hi.
So
welcome.
So, okay. Well, now I'll tell my version of that story.
Oh, shit. Okay, please.
No. I remember meeting you and thinking, who is this powerful, beautiful bitch? No.
Like, okay.
Or you were just like, I thought you had, like, in my story in my head, it was like you were surrounded by people, like a force and a light. And I was like, I was so fascinated and curious about you. And like, that you think I'm intimidating is funny, because I'm so awkward at parties, actually. Like, I consider myself an introvert. And so I loved, and really what I'd rather be doing is reading and doing books. And so the fact that I bought your book, of course, you've just told me, I've just met you, you're fascinating, you're like magnetic. And of course, I'm going to immediately buy your book and read it. And I'm so curious. And I love talk. That was the highlight of my holiday season, actually, was getting to not only meet you, but like, I don't know, I'm just at a place in my life where I don't want to have party conversations. Like, it's fun, but like, we were having intense conversations, and then the dream woman came in, and like, you know, and it was like at a level of like talking, that wasn't wine fueled, but it was just like a deep connection. Like, these are the kind of people I want to meet and have conversations, and Bridget. And obviously we both love Peggy, who's hosting the party. It was just like, really, like, I loved it. I've been to that party many times, my favorite time at the party because of that.
I feel the same. I feel the very same. And it felt like we were like transported to like a salon in like Paris or something.
Yes,
like, all Paris. Of a sudden we are like deep talking about these really like earth shattering conversations, topics, and just connecting. It was like the world around us fell apart and it was just us in the room. And I remember,
Are we in love? No.
Yes, naturally, honey. And I just want to name, you know, because it's to me when I meet a, and I mean this with like genuine care and genuine like appreciation. When I meet an older woman who sees me and who cares for me, even the way you hugged me, like all these things matter. When someone like me, who's like a mama's boy, who talked to mom every day, multiple times a day, loses their beloved. When I met you and the way you cared for me, initially our first interaction was like, ooh, you're saucy. I like you. And then I was just like, okay, cool. If we get to, because you work with so many extremely powerful people, people who are like in this wellness spiritual space for, you know, 3, 4, 5 decades. It's like, it's a whole nother level. And I'm just coming into it like, oh, hi, you know, hoping to help people. You know, I know I'm helping people, but you know what I'm saying? It's just another caliber. Yeah. It's like you're talking, the people that you've worked with and work with, they're helping people on a global scale. It's a little different.
Yeah.
And just the way you came back and we reinterected, it was just like, oh, I remember like tears were in my eyes. I remember it like welling up because of the care. Anyways, this is probably why the name of your new book is Mama Love, right? The Many Lives of Mama Love, which is what I want to talk about today. Like, why this title, Mama Love?
So, you know, I think I have naturally always had a lot of mom energy. And obviously, I have four boys. I've given birth to two stepchildren that I've raised. And then Mama Love was my jail nickname.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been to jail.
I've been to jail. Yes.
Okay.
So that is the, you know, that was, I was in jail with a lot of girls who were young, not much older than my oldest son, and mother energy who, you know, I have that mother energy. I'm a caretaker. I'm a helper. And I was at the rock bottom in my life, lost everything that made up who I was. It was all gone. And that's my energy, right? And so that was the, everyone in jail has a nickname, by the way. Like everyone has a nickname. So that was my jail nickname. So the original title of my book, when it sold to Simon Schuster, had a different title. And then it got changed to that. The original title was The Neighbor from Hell and Other People I Have Been. So
I equally love that title. But let's talk about time in jail and offering care and support and sweetness and mother energy to total strangers. And, you know, because it like you could become sour when you are incarcerated. You could become hopeless, helpless, suicidal, and sick, psychologically, physically, and spiritually sick. But I think that you were able to defy and dismantle the punitive justice system by being a restorative person in the system. Would you agree?
I would agree that all of those things you said are true. I was also all of those things. Right? Both things are true. I was all of those things. And the women, and you know, like, what did I know from jail but what I've seen on TV and movies, right? And that's just, you know, so I didn't know. But what I found was I was with a group of women. You know, my best friend was 19 at the time. I was 40, right? My oldest son was 17. A group of women who 100% have suffered trauma in their life. 80% of them are mothers separated from their children, like I was. And we saved each other, you know, like we saved each other. And, you know, the energy I gave, not that it wasn't like horrible and ugly and miserable and the worst thing, and I never want to go back, and I still have dreams that I have to go back. That's also true. But when people are going through something together, no matter what, it, you know, you form a family, right? Like people will form a family wherever they are, I think, you know, and especially if they're not with their own family or don't want to be with their own family, like people will naturally gravitate to forming a family and community. And so, yeah, I mean, that's how it feels good to help people too, you know, and I was really at the lowest point in my life, and everyone else in the community outside of jail, I had no community there. I was a hated member of the community, it felt like at that time and for a long time after. So, but I was, you know, there was a point in the beginning that I write about in the book when I was arrested where, you know, when I was arrested, my youngest son was home. He was almost four at the time and he got taken away by Child Protective Services, which, and I was brought to jail and I was crying the whole time. Like, where is he? Where is he going? You know, where have they taken him? And the deputy kind of paused between the police car and the jail. There's like this little entryway. And I remember it so well. You're kind of between two doors. So there's no one else there. And he looked at me and he said, "You will never see your son again. You should not be anyone's mother." And like, I believed him in that moment, you know? And it's so, you know, like now, and I wasn't a place, like when you're at your lowest and when you're in shame and when you're in guilt and all the things, you're not really going to be like, let me advocate. That's not fair to say. I wasn't like that. I just internalized it, said, oh my God, he's right. I'm bad. And I can't, I don't have the spiritual strength or the spark or anything to get through never seeing my children again, if that's true, or to get through anything. So it really led to like my darkest night where I was going to end my life there. And so, you know, now looking back, it's like, dude, you could have just said like, it's okay. He's safe. You know, like the humanity could have been there and it's often not, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know if I answered your question, but yeah.
No, you answered my question. Yeah. You answered my question and opened the door for a whole nother set of questions. But can we briefly talk about what happened to the kids when you were taken away and how long were you incarcerated for?
I was incarcerated for a year. My youngest son was the only one home at the time. My other boys were you met one of them, I think, Cody. One of them, two were in high school and one was in junior high. So they weren't at home when I was arrested. So they were just able to go to their dad's, my ex-husband's house. And then Caden went into foster care and he was young and he was like, he'd never spent a night away from me. You know, he's at that stranger danger age. And he was
so
like,
he actually went to foster care.
Yeah. Child Protective Services. I was begging them at my house, please let me call someone. You know, he'd just been with the stuffed animals watching a cartoon and they kind of barreled in. And I said, please let me call someone to get him. And they said, nope. And they called Child Protective Services and they came and took him into foster care, into, you know, emergency foster care. So he's with strangers and I couldn't, you know, he needed me to scratch his arm to sleep at night, you know, and I couldn't bear it, but I couldn't bear that I caused this. Like I did this to him, you know? So he was in foster care and then my ex-husband had my boys and his wife, they got a little while later emergency certified. So he got to live with them for the year. So he got to be with his brothers, which was great. And that's the only reason I was able to live through that year.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Holy fucking shit. Okay. Now let me ask you a deep question, really deep. And then I want to move into, you know, and this is obviously woven into the book, but do you think you needed to go to be incarcerated? Do you think you and the people who are in prison, is that a good thing to go to prison? And is being punished and being put away and isolated. Do you think that you learned your lesson? Do you think that you became a better person? That's the question I don't ask.
Yeah.
Did you become a better person by going to jail?
I will speak for me that going to jail was the best thing that could have happened for me, which is a different question than the first when you were first asking this.
Yeah.
I think whether, you know, I did things that went against my values and broke laws and I should be punished for them. So there's that piece, you know, I think because we have laws and we have rules and I hurt people. But I think there's so much more to unpack with that. But when you say, is it a good thing that we lock people up? It depends what what you're wanting the result of that to be. Right. So if the result is you want to punish someone forever and punish generations, then that's a really good thing. Cause that's usually what happens no matter what, you know, I thought, being my first
time in jail. Wait, did you say punishing a generation? It's a good thing.
I'm saying like what the outcome is you want. You want to lock someone. You want to do it to deter crime. Maybe that'll work, but the prisons are overcrowded and the jails are overcrowded, so maybe it doesn't work. Do you want to do it to keep people safe? Maybe that helps in some cases. I think for people struggling with addiction and mental health issues, locking them up, separating them from their children, and then creating all these barriers when they get out so that they can never rebuild their life and always keep going back over stupid reasons, like they don't have transportation, then it's not a good thing. No. Mm-hmm. You know, but I think for me personally, the experience of going to jail, while horrible, while collateral damage with my children, was the absolute best thing for my life. Like, one, I think some of us learn things the hard way, right? Some of us just have to learn things the hard way. And I tend to be an overachiever in everything I do. So, like, I'm going to have to overachieve in my rock bottom, right? And so I think, one, if I hadn't stopped 15 years ago using opiates, I would probably not be alive right now because there's the whole fentanyl crisis. I think if I hadn't had every identity that I had, that every role that I had in place that made up who I was to the world stripped away, like, I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I drive a minivan, you know, if I didn't have all that, I never would have figured out who I was. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And I learned to meditate in jail, which is a great place. There's easier ways. But, you know, it really, I got to rebuild myself at 40 into who I really was. And so that was good for that reason. It made me a better mother, made me more real, you know, made me so my boys could always talk to me about anything because, you know, I showed them how to fail spectacularly and get back, like, spectacularly, you know. So I don't want to ever go back, and I'm glad I went at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad. I'm happy we're having this conversation because it's oftentimes I don't have access to talking to people who've gone through the system in this way. I am on the outside reading research and talking to people like Gabor Mate and being able to hear and Fritzi, who runs the Compassion Prison Project, and so between Fritzi and Gabor, I'm hearing two massive experts in the field of mental health and incarceration and punitive justice. Just hearing that the vast majority of people who are incarcerated are there because of a mental illness, because of trauma that's been in their family, in their lineage, that goes back much longer than you know, that they can even, you know, account for. And they've been abused, so all they know is to abuse. They've been hurt, so all they know is to hurt. So they're just recreating a cycle that didn't start with them. And the prisons are crowded with the most traumatized people in society. And we are not healing trauma by putting people away. We are causing pain to people who are already in pain. And I also really enjoy you, who I am inspired by, who's written this incredible book, who works with global healers, that was a good thing for you. It was almost like you went to a year-long meditation retreat. I'm never going to be out in the public saying this. I'm saying it on the record now, but because of the context, but that line can't be taken out of the context of this whole conversation. But that's what I'm hearing. Yeah. And I just want to say that for the listener, because I'm constantly advocating for restorative justice. I'm constantly advocating for punishment is not the way to restore someone's values, ethical code, moral capacity, center goodness, any of that. I believe that it's only through, you know, therapeutic methods, through safety, to kindness. Like, even the thing that the officer said to you, like, fuck you for saying that.
Yeah.
Like, how awful.
I mean, that led me to tie a sheet around my neck 3 nights later because I just really believed I had failed at life.
Oh.
I was good. Redemption stories are for good. I was just bad. I would never see them again. I couldn't deal with that. Like, you know, like the ripples of that. What is the ripples of just saying it's going to be okay to someone, even if it isn't, you know, like and my crimes were not, like, I've never had a violent moment in my life except for throwing a head of lettuce, you know? So I think, I think restorative justice is good, but I think it's not even, what did you just say? You said, to restore people to their goodness or whatever. I actually think people still they all have that in them. It's not that they've lost it and it's gone away. It's in there, but it's like covered up with the trauma, the you know, addiction. Gabor Mate taught me this. Addiction is a symptom. You know, he asked me, he's like, Laura, what were you looking for when you were taking opiates. And I was like, I was looking for connection. I was looking for joy for no good reason. I was looking for love. I was looking for validation, you know, like all of those things. But mostly to me, the way it was in my brain, like if I took a prescribed pain pill, then I felt brighter, shinier, funnier, better. I could look you in the eye and connect with you more without being, you know, like it was, I needed that. I thought I needed that to do that. And so one of the things, you know, it's 15 years without taking any opiates, but I always make sure that I'm getting that in my life. Right. So my relapse trigger isn't like I want to use drugs. Like I'm going through a hard time now. Like it doesn't even cross my mind. But if I'm feeling a lack of connection, if I'm not feeling love, if I'm not feeling my community, if I'm not feeling joy, if I'm, you know, like I'm on alert, or if I'm pretending in any area of my life, I'm saying yes when I mean no. I'm putting up my look good rather than being real. Like I'm just hyper vigilant to all those things now. And that's my relapse triggers, right? Like that's my thing. Cause it's just a symptom. You know, no one in prison is like, oh, I hope I grow up and like go to prison or become an addict, or, you know, that's just not the case. And I think, you know, women, what happens for generations is because you get out of jail or prison on probation or parole, and there's all these obstacles. There's all these illogical consequences, right? To use it like, you know, if we give a kid a timeout, it should be a logical consequence to what they did, you know, to relate them. But you get out and they're like, no, you can't, you have to get a job, but you have to get a job where you can leave on a moment's notice a drug test for three different agencies. And you have to have housing, but oh, you have a criminal record, so you can't go through a property management. You're in the underground housing. And then these women get exploited and trafficked, and then they're back in jail. Or they can't, you know, get childcare because the subsidies, you can't get subsidies if you're have a criminal record. You know, it's like all these ways in which you have to pay for a lifetime. And that's how generations have trauma. Mm-hmm. The system causes the trauma because, you know, you have 80% of the women I was in jail are mothers of minor children. So they're all in foster care or family care. But you have in a system, a county saying you have, you've been sentenced to 18 months in jail. And then the other side of the county system in the courtroom next door says, okay, you have a year to meet all these requirements to get your child back. That's why kids are in foster care. So like not logical or coordinated too. It's
That's
crazy.
So fucked up. That is yeah. So fucked up.
And I, you know, and for me, I got out of jail. I'm a middle-aged, middle-class white woman with a master's degree, some family support and all the privilege that comes with that. And it was still almost impossible for me to not go back to jail for reasons that had nothing to do with committing a crime. And there were times when I felt like I might actually be safer there because of judgment, bias, gossip, all of the things that people view. Like, you know, it didn't matter that I had anything I'd done up until the point I went to jail. That was all erased. I was no longer a good mother. I was no longer smart. I was no longer a business owner. I was no longer any of those things. I was now just this one worse thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then wow. To get over that is really fucking hard for people.
Oops.
We froze.
Hello. Hello. Hello.
Hi, we're back.
What happened? Oh my goodness.
You were frozen.
I was like, where did you go? Okay, I marked it for the producers. 2212 okay. Is when, and you were saying that coming out of jail, it was like coming out of jail was really hard to rebuild yourself, to like yeah. Re-enter society.
Yeah, because I was like, okay, good. Like I'm actually a rule follower. Like I've followed all the rules in jail. I've done my sentence. I'm going to follow the rules on probation. All good. And I just didn't realize like how many ways you have to keep paying. And that's how generations pay because you know, the number one predictor of recidivism, people going back to jail is poverty. Right. And then we have, it's so hard to get a job and a house and a car and all these things. So yeah, it's kind of a messy system. I started a nonprofit right before the book launched that's doing gender and trauma responsive care for women only in jail and incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women, because that's what's missing. It needs to be trauma responsive care. So
say more about that. Women. So what is it? How does it actually help people?
It's programming that. So first of all, women are the last. They're the last population in the budgets at prisons and jails. Right. It's the fastest growing population of incarcerated, 750% increase in incarcerated women. They're mothers. Women, the data shows statistically, they respond to programming better than men. And these facilities were built for men. They are controlled by men. And you have a group of traumatized, like 100% have trauma, like domestic violence, childhood abuse, sexual assault, like 100, you know, maybe it's 99.999. I'm just a writer. I don't know the statistics, but it's close to 100% have trauma, and they're in an environment that is triggering and re-traumatizing every day. If you, you know, there's this woman who, you know, defended herself in a domestic violence situation, right? We know the red flags for domestic violence. Do they control your access to your family? Do they control what you eat? Do they, that is what jail is 24 hours a day. It's men controlling everything, whether you can even have shampoo, you know? So it's like, no, there's no trauma-informed care or programming for women. And that's why we have 400,000 children also in foster care. Like, it's all connected, you know? So, yeah, so there's a lot of work to do. So programming in custody for women, and then it's that bridge. So those same people have support when they get out. You know, I did a little programming when I got out. There was no support. I was on my own. So we're doing both things. So in custody programming, then support for women when they get out with services and transportation and help, so they don't go back to jail for all of the reasons that have nothing to do with committing a crime, which is why people go back. And why they're, you know, and you're more likely to be homeless, you're more, all those things. And then we're creating a model site and providing support so it can hopefully be replicated across the country. And it's hard because every county is different, every state. So
this is incredible. Oh my God. Let us know how we can help. I mean, yeah. Honored and so inspired by you, my darling. Wow. Okay. Before we,
that's my side hustle.
Yeah. I mean, what a casual side hustle, just darling. Side oh my hustle. God. Yeah. I fucking love your side hustle. Like, holy shit. What an epic. What? Wow. So inspired. I want to hear about your time taking heroin. Like, what propelled you to do that? And do you think that your heroin use kind of became a catalyst for you to do things that you weren't proud of? And then that led you to be incarcerated?
Yeah. So the actual like heroin use was a brief time in my struggle with addiction. And it's a familiar story. Like I grew up in a family of with a lot of addiction and alcoholism and a lot of trauma and a lot of no one said a word about anything. And when I was a young mom with three boys and I was in my first marriage and I was my husband was cheating on me and I was super unhappy and depressed and like I was so determined to have this like you know perfect family that I used to see on sitcoms when I was a kid. You know, I thought everybody else's family was normal but mine growing up. And I was like, I'm going to have a perfect family and I'm going to, you know, be everything my mother was not. And I'm going to be with them. You know, like that was my thing. So when my marriage was, you know, my husband cheated me and it was like, oh, this is not going to be like the sitcoms I saw, you know, I was really depressed. And in those days, this is like mid-90s, Vicodin specifically, it's an opiate pill, was handed out in sample packs everywhere. You know, this is why we have an opiate crisis now, right? Like it was literally you visit the doctor for anything like, oh, try this new pain medication. You have an earache. You're in a mood. It's like how they used to give women opium back in the Victorian days, you know, like when they're hysterical. So I had been prescribed that maybe for childbirth or like whatever it was. And I remember I took one day not because I was in any physical pain. I was in emotional pain. And it lit up my brain in a way. I was like, oh, I'm actually happy. Everything's going to be okay. It helped me. That was it. It helped me. Like, I think I was self-medicating depression. And I, at that time, I was not someone who would ever say I had a problem. I would never say I needed help with anything. I was so invested. That's how I grew up. And I was so independent and invested in other people thinking that I was okay and had my shit together and was perfect. So, you know, that one pill, and I think too, it was like, okay, now I can play laundry and Army Guys. Cause like, you know, being home alone with three kids is not always the most fun. No offense to the children out there, but it's not the most exciting thing always. And so it just helped me be, pretend I was happy. And then it took two, and then it took three. And then I'd be like, oh, this might be a problem, so I better stop. And then I was like, oh, I don't have a problem. I stopped. Then I'll take one again. You know, like it went on that way, on and off. And I was very highly functioning. I was a real estate agent. I owned businesses. I was a good mom. But I knew it was always there. And until the point where I was taking 60 a day.
60.
Yeah. 20 for breakfast, 20 for lunch, 20 for dinner. That's how tolerance and addiction like builds over time. Right. And, you know, I'd stopped for 6 years, got remarried, and someone I'd met in the recovery community. And then he relapsed on, I found some heroin in my house, and I Googled literally on the way to a school event, how do you smoke heroin? And that was it. And I still kept it a secret. And then that's the thing that I swore I would never, ever do in my whole life. You know, like my brother died of a heroin overdose. My sister died when I was a teenager in a drunk driving accident. And I was like, I'll never be like them. You know, like I'm going to focus on school and education and work. And that's the story that happens with people with opiate addiction, eventually, because it's cheaper and easier. And that's just that's how it goes. And so it's such a devastating, deadly thing that in 1 year I'd lost everything, my house, my business. And I got arrested because, you know, I was still trying to pretend everything was fine and there was no more money because it's very expensive and it's cheaper, but it's like, you know, it just consumes everything. And I kept saying like I knew right from wrong. I knew this wasn't who I wanted to be, but I could not ask for help. And I remember like a month before I got arrested, like I knew everything was closing in. Like a month before, I remember thinking, there's no way in hell I could go away to like a rehab for 30 days and be separated from my children for 30 days. So I can't tell anyone I have a problem. And then I was arrested for years. Like, mm-hmm. You know, like that was my thinking. And so,
wow.
Yeah. And that is just, that's how it, like, you really get to this point where you think you will die if you don't have it. Mm-hmm. So it's not even a choice. It's not a right or wrong choice in that moment. It's like any survival choice in a survival mm-hmm. thing all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, and I kept thinking, okay, I'll just smoke a little today and then I will figure out my life and stop tomorrow. You know, like it was always like tomorrow I'll figure it out, but I couldn't ever. And I had no tools at that point to like not do it. You know, like that's, I don't even know. It's so hard to explain if you're not in it. It's a compulsion, it's an obsession.
Oh, I know, I know the word. You know, I didn't get into heroin. But you know, crack cocaine, I was smoking crack when I was 14 years old.
Oh,
so I know the look, honey. I know the look. Yeah. I know the obsession. Yeah. I know the tunnel vision. I know the crippling desire. I know that feeling that unless you have it, you can't move forward. Yeah. There's no living without it. Right. I know that from such a young age. So
And there's comfort too. Like every day was miserable because you're just all about getting it and, you know, maintaining and doing what you do. But I realized like for me, there was something comfortable in knowing how every day was going to be too. So later when I'm not on it, I'm like, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Like I had to walk through that terror, like as something that I'm like, oh, I don't know. Like, am I comfortable with not knowing how tomorrow's going to be, even if it could be good? Like that was like a thing I had to, that was one of the things that was great that I went to jail and everything was stripped away and I learned to meditate, you know. The first book I read in there that I had was Eckhart Tolle's Power of Now. And I just read it over and over again and it saved my life. And then Mark Nepo saved my life, you know, like,
oh, those I love
the books.
Mark Nepo. Wow.
Oh my God. He's my absolute favorite in the world. And I read his Book of Awakening, like in the last half of the time in jail. And I read it like a horoscope. Cause you know, he would have it dates. Mm-hmm. So I just started that date, you know, and time is weird in jail and you're always like crossing off the calendar and it's moving slow. And so I'd go and see what does he have for me today? And the thing that changed my life, and that is like it's his words. I wrote about it in the book, is he wrote, pain pushes until vision pulls. And that's like, that's the thing. Like if I ever get a tattoo, I don't have any of that. I would get that probably. But that was just, I was like, oh, I've been operating. And this is, you know, for 10 years post jail, I was letting pain push me too until vision pulled. Cause I was like keeping my secret and didn't want anyone to find out about my past while working with all those great people you mentioned, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but that was like, yeah, who do I want to be? I don't want to be someone who's just going through every day pushed by their pain, whatever that pain is in the day or from childhood or for whatever. I want to like have a vision pull me. And that mm-hmm. is like a huge shift.
Mm-hmm. What's the craziest story in the book?
The what?
The craziest story in the book.
Mm.
You don't need to tell us the whole thing, but just give us like a little juicy little snippet because everyone must get this book and get it on Audible too because she narrates it.
I do narrate it. And so there's a lot of crazy, unbelievable stories like post-jail, but I'll tell you the craziest one. Like it was really one of the most fun days in jail. It was crazy. So there's, like I said, 80%, I'll tell you a jail story. 80% of women in jail, I said, are mothers. So there was this woman in there and I can't remember because I had to change everybody's name. So I don't remember her book name. So whatever, I know her real name, but I don't give that. So she was pregnant. She was in jail and she was pregnant and she was about maybe 4 or 5 months pregnant. It was her first pregnancy. And we were sitting around and we were just super bored. Like we're all bored. Like time is slow. And it's just, and as punishment, they played country music videos 24/7, the guards in the, 24 hours, like during daytime hours, they wouldn't let us do anything on the TV. So it was just like country music videos and we were bored. And you have a lot of people who are getting, they're not getting any coping skills programming, right? So they're not learning how to manage their feelings. And they're like, you know, and they're all, some are detoxing and some have never gone this long without having some kind of drug coping mechanism. So everyone was bored and restless. And we were like, it'd be so great to have some hot paramedics in here. Oh, we started talking about like how hot paramedics are in general. I have two brothers who are paramedics, but like how, yeah, they're always so cute. We started talking about firemen and paramedics and how hot they are. And then we're like, she's like, what if I fake labor and we get paramedics in here for everyone to see the paramedics? And so,
oh shit.
So we hatch a plan. It's like an episode. It's like Scooby-Doo. We hatch a plan. And so, but she's like, Laura, what do I do? I've never been in labor. What should I, you know, like I had to coach her on faking labor pains. And so she started doing that moaning like, oh, something's wrong. And so we call, you know, we press the button. It's what you do. And they came in and they called the paramedics. And then they made us all lock in the rooms. There's like an open area and then locked rooms. So except for her, they made all of us lock in the rooms, which we hadn't planned on. So we're all like peeking through these little windows, trying to see them. They're very good looking. But then they take her out and take her to the hospital. And we're like, oh no. You know? So, but as she was leaving, she's moaning, she just like gave a little wave to it. You know, like she was happy to go, you know, it was like breaking up the monotony. Mm-hmm.
A little wink, and, seeing a bit.
Yeah. And that, like that to me was fun, right? It was fun and light and silly. And it was like a little thing, but then something happened right after. And I, having not been in jail before, I didn't know this was going to happen. I didn't think about it. I was like mortified. All of a sudden, everybody runs to the payphones and starts calling their drug dealers and saying, hey, my friend's going to be at the emergency room. Go drop something off with her as a way to get drugs in. And I was like, oh, I didn't know that. It turned like the fun playfulness and the silliness turned into that obsession again. And then it turned, yeah. And then it just, you can read about it in the book, but.
Wow. Mm-hmm. It got dark real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know, before we talk about you having, you know, met Oprah, the Dalai Lama, Desmond Tutu, like these casually some of the most iconic people in the world. And I want to hear, you know, what is the biggest takeaway that you have from having been around these people, having worked with them, having, you know, engaged with them? You share two of your siblings are paramedics, but you also shared two other ones have died, a brother and a sister. How have you coped with the grief?
So,
because I like to say cope, because I believe it never goes away. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm a year in and I feel like my body's going through worse psychosomatic experiences, worse than the week after my mother died. The month before my body was collapsing, panic attack, conjunctivitis, back pain, chest pain, like you name it, a torn ligament on my left foot. I've had the works and a year later and right now I'm going through such a health crisis too. Mm. And it's, you know, reading research about it and people's experiences. It's like, shit, I'm in that 1 year cycle. It's like resurfacing all of it again. So how did you cope with losing siblings? It's like, it sounds like.
So my two brothers who are paramedics are, I got an entirely new family 7 years ago that I didn't know about.
Have you ever watched someone share their skincare routine and wondered, oh my God, those 7 steps in the morning, those 7 steps at night, that's what it takes to have healthy, glowing skin? Then guess what, honey? I don't want it. It's just way too complicated. I'm all about simplifying my life in every area that I possibly can because being human is already so complicated. So can I simplify my skincare routine, please? So if you're tired of these multi-step protocols, if you're tired of these overly complicated routines, my darling, I'm excited to share with you today's sponsor, OneSkin. Their products make it easy to keep your skin healthy and glowing. And listen, you know how, if you've been listening to the podcast for a while or followed me on social, you've heard me talk about how I have acne scars. You know, over 10 years ago, I used to have cystic acne. And the cystic acne, because I was a wild creature, I would pop in myself and it would leave these, you know, really deep scars. And using the OS1 face topical supplement has drastically changed the texture and feel of my skin. And the secret is OneSkin's proprietary OS1 peptide. It's the first ingredient to provenly switch off the aging cells that causes lines, wrinkles, and thinning skin. It is such a simple approach to it. I wash my face with the bar of soap that I wash my body. Maybe I don't recommend that for everybody, up to you. And then I just apply this. And then after I put the OS1 face topical supplement, I put on sunscreen and I'm game. I'm ready to go. You know, they have so many studies to back this product up. And just don't take my word for it. You know, they have over 4,000 five-star reviews. You heard that right. 4,000 five-star reviews. And they're recognized by Fast Company as one of the most innovative brands in 2024. And guess what, darling? For a limited time, you, as the listener of the Spiritually Sassy Show, you get an exclusive 15% off your first OneSkin purchase using the code SA, capital S, capital A, and capital H. My first name. Plug it into the checkout and you get 15% off. And you have to head over to oneskin.co, not .com, .co. So it's one, spell it out, oneskin.co. And plug inside, check out, and enjoy that gorgeous, glowing, healthy skin, because you're worth it. And let's find a simple way of doing it. Peace.
I got an entirely new family 7 years ago that I didn't know about, and a new dad. So they weren't part of my family growing up. And that was one of those things where I was like, this is just too much even for a memoir. Like, I just left that out. I didn't even go in there because it was just so crazy. And it happened right as my mom died. And I was like, okay, that's it. I have no more family, you know? And then I, you know, my mom was a secret keeper, as many women in her generation were. And so I got this entirely new family. But, you know, when my sister died, I was 19. And I just remember, like, it being surreal. Like, I was like, wait, I didn't have any sense of, like, how is someone there and then they're not there? Like, I couldn't understand it. It was my first experience with death. It was tragic in a car accident. You know, I got a call in California. I was just about to start college and I flew back home. And all of that is so vivid in the fact that there was no way to deal with grief because nobody talked about grief. You know, like there was no, it was just chaos. You know, my mom, I just remember my mom being in big glasses and like her jaw, she wasn't saying anything, but her jaw, you would just see her jaw clenching. And I had to go buy like a dress for my sister to be buried in, you know. And first of all, my sister would not want to wear a dress, but it was just like the everything felt very surreal. And like, the world didn't look the same ever. Right. And so what happened is then I went, no one said anything. No one, you know, again, I grew up in a family where there is no one ever said like, how was your day? Or how are you feeling? Like there was, that language did not exist. So it was just like, go there, get the dress, bury. I went back to college, and how it manifested for me was I suddenly became afraid everyone was going to die. Right. I didn't know that was a thing. I thought that was just me, but I was just like, anyway, like I had this constant anxiety. And here's the thing in my family, my sister died. She died in 1986. No one in my family ever mentioned her name again. That's how I learned to deal with grief. Right. And when I tried, as I got older and I was a mom and I'm, you know, like breaking cycles, and I would try to bring her up, you know, my mom would just burst into tears and that was it. And then my brother died of a heroin overdose. And again, same thing. Like there were no rituals of grief. And so when my mom died, I was with her, you know, with her through the whole last weeks and, you know, having to give her the morphine on hospice and like all of those things. And I tried to talk to her, like, cause you know, she's on hospice, you know, mm-hmm. and she refused to acknowledge that she would, like, death was not spoken about. Mm-hmm. And she would not even acknowledge she was dying. So we never got to have any conversations like that as I'm taking care of her. And this is going to be really sad and horrible and painful, but it's true. So, you know, I'm someone who, like, I want to say all the things. That's who I am now. I'm different than my family, you know, and I want to make sure people know they're loved and they say what they need to say. And my mom wasn't that way. And I was trying to get there, you know, and with her. But she had a moment of lucidity, like, you know, the last week of death, as you know, there was a beautiful moment at the beginning we had where she talked about, it seemed like she was in two places at once and was really different for a minute. And then it got really hard. And she had a moment of kind of lucidity. I was carrying her into the bathroom. She weighed like 85 pounds and I was carrying her in. And she opened her eyes and she looked right in my eyes. She goes, Lara, what's happening? And so me being me and seeing the world through my eyes and what I want and think should be how it is, I said, Mom, like really gently, you're dying. And she looked at me and we grew up on the East Coast, right? So we're like, where ladies don't even say damn. You know, it was like that. And she looked at me and she goes, well, that's very prim and proper. Well, that's a very cruel thing to say. And those were her fucking last words to me. So when she died, I lost it. Because I was like, oh my God, I didn't handle everything right. What did I do wrong? Did I give her the morphine I gave her kill? Did I kill her? Like I started calling psychic mediums to try and to contact her because I wanted her to tell me I had done everything, you know, it still makes me tear up because it was, I would say me being in the middle. It was the first time I got to experience grief actually with her because it was so shut down when I was younger. And then I was messing, you know, I still go to like CVS, like a CVS pharmacy, and like I had to give her all this Ensure stuff, and I see that aisle and I'm like, oh, and walk, you know, like there's all those things. I wore one of her shirts and it's really hard. And the difference, you know, I told you this before we did the show, but my dad died on January 1st of this year, just 2 weeks ago. And when we're done here, I'm heading off to, you know, do memorials and stuff in Arizona. And I got that news on New Year's Day, right as I landed on like touchdown between the walk to the plane to baggage claim. I was like, oh, it's so beautiful. It's a New Year day. The sky is blue. I'm going to have a few days retreat. And then I had meetings. I was in Florida. I'd never been to Florida before. I was at Key West. And when I got to baggage claim, my sister called. And I was like, oh. And I go out and I burst into tears. And I'm sitting in front of this little tiny airport in Key West, Florida. And security is looking at me. And I'm sobbing. And I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. And I had that moment of like, oh my God, I'm all alone and someone has died again, right? because with my mom, I was all alone in those weeks with her. And then, so I didn't know, I Ubered to the hotel. I was supposed to check in because I just wasn't sure what to do. And there's like two flights a day out of there. And what I did is I called, like, I realized, oh my God, what is different this time in my grief? I'm not going through it alone. Like, I have a community. Like, I called and I didn't go, I didn't say, oh, I got to be strong for anyone. And that's how I've done things a lot. And so I got in my hotel room. I called my oldest son and cried to him. And I said, can you call everyone? I can't do it. And then I called my girlfriend and she's like someone who, what do you need me to do? But she's, you know what she told me? She goes, you, and I'd been up all night at times. And she goes, you can't go to sleep right now because you'll wake up in the middle of the night and be all alone. She goes, you need to go get a massage. I was like, it's New Year's Day. And she goes, you need to go get a massage. And I was like, okay. Like, I was just going to do whatever anyone told me to do. And I was like, okay. So I went, you know, after talking to my family and my sister, and I went and got this very painful Thai massage. Like, you know, just it was the only place open New Year's Eve. And it was very painful, but what it did is it grounded me instantly because I'd already gone to, oh my God, why did I text on Christmas to my dad? Why didn't I call? And I didn't even know, like, what's happening? You know, and I just started mad at myself. And mad, I started, like, getting in, like, things, you know, old habits of, like, you know, berating myself or whatever. And so I went and got that massage and it just got me, like, in my body. It was very painful and good, like, grounded me. And I was like, okay. And then I slept and then I started dealing with stuff. But you know, I've gone through a lot of really hard things in my life and I've always gone through them alone. And this time in my life, when I go through them, I'm not going through them alone. Like, I have these both, like, love and support from people close to me and deep connections. And I have no desire to try and hide my mess from people like I used to do. Right? I'm just like real now, you know? So I'm not going to hide my mess from people and I'm not going to be like, I'm sorry, is this too much? I'm just going to be like, here's all the things going on.
And everybody goes through it. Everybody goes through it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like this moment too, where I was like, oh, here's, you know, the subtitle of my book is a memoir of lying, stealing, writing, and healing. And I was like, oh, here's one of those moments where you've done all this work and you say you've been healing and you've been doing this and studying this and reading this and hanging out with these wise people. What do you actually do when the velocity and the heat are here? Like, what do you do? And I was like, oh, I'm doing everything differently from how I've done it before. That's good. Like, I'm just noticing that, you know? Yeah. So.
Oh my God. So much to unpack here. I do. I do want to name one thing too, that when you said, oh, I have to go buy my sister a dress. I remember 3-4 hours after my mother died, my dad and my sister look at me and says, you have to go figure out what mom's going to wear. Because I am the fashion queen of the family. So I had to go into her closet and I'm like choking up thinking about it. I had to go into her closet and pick the fucking dress and the jewelry. And I had to tell my sister the kind of makeup to go with the dress. Just like, what an awful, tragic experience to go through. And I was shoved and cornered into doing it. I'm happy I did it in retrospect, right? I got to choose the clothes that my mom went for her last big event, the biggest event of her life. I got to choose what she wore. And also how fucked up of an experience that anyone has to go through. This is why talking about death earlier on is way better. Mm-hmm. That mom gets to select her dress. That sister gets to select what she's going to wear. That we all have our health directives, our pink slip, whatever, you know, like all the things in place before we are faced with the inevitable death.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So and it's going to happen. So not doing it doesn't make it not happen.
Exactly. Exactly. Which is so fucked. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about something that we didn't get a chance to talk about, but it's so big in my work and it's clearly so massive in your work too. We need to talk about this and we need to talk about the holy beings and the mega stars. Okay. Important things to talk about, especially because, you know, they're Oprah, Dalai Lama, Desmond Tutu, like they're casual people that I'm just like, holy fucking shit. Mm-hmm. Yes. And after I met you at that party, I had just
it was my Desmond Tutu and I dinner.
Oh my God. Guys, for those of you listening, she showed me a photo of her and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, like holding hands, kind of like a big hug, really. Oh, yeah. Wow. That's so beautiful.
Love that picture.
Thank you for sharing that with me. Wow. So incredible that you've like shared intimate moments with these holy beings. Okay, but before we talk about these holy famous people, let's talk about the sentence, something that you wrote, which I think it's so profound. You say, shame is a poison worse than heroin. Talk about shame and how to work with shame, process shame, because shame is different than grief. Grief, I say, cope with. Shame, I say, let go, process, transform, because that poison, it's not something that we have to learn to coexist with. It's something that we have to actively do our best to uproot, to burn it down, to let it go, like hopefully with practice completely. So these are the last two things I need from you before we close this episode. Okay,
good. So, you know, obviously shame, I spent 10 years post jail while working with all the fancy people we're going to talk about, keeping my past a secret, that I was formerly incarcerated, that I was locked up, that I was called the neighbor from hell, all those things, and living in so much fear that people would find out, and trying to, you know, it's like, can't, you know, eventually people find out everything, you know, like it's the internet, you just had to Google me. But it was like, can I prove myself good fast enough so that when that comes out, those two things can be somewhat even, right? Like I was just trying to prove I was good because I really didn't believe I was good. And I really was like, it's not even just like failure at life, but it was just like, I'm obviously not a good person. I have to prove I'm a good person. And I have to, you know, like when I met the Dalai Lama, I was like, oh my God, he's going to know I'm not good. He's going to look at my soul and be like, what's this bad person doing here? That's shame, right? It wasn't like I had like guilt for the people I hurt in my addiction. And I paid my due, like I paid my sentence and I paid my restitution, but I was ashamed of that part of my story. And so I, you know, shame and secrets and keeping secrets, all of that, I did that for so, I wish I had not, I feel like I wasted 10 years and I wasted a lot of those experiences, because when you're with the Dalai Lama and meditating in his private residence that he's invited you to, and you're not fully present because a part of you is worried he's going to know that you're a bad person, that's a wasted opportunity, right? Like I wasn't 100% present there because I had shame and I was thinking about myself too, which is, you know, but so, you know, shame is a poison and you can't just get it out. You can't just be like, okay, my shame's done, drop my shame today. It's like you need community, right? That's all I found. Like shame heals in community. That's how you get it out. Right? It heals for people who have legitimate things, like I can speak to formerly incarcerated women who are full of shame and mothers, you know, it's not gonna just go away unless people see them for more than that, right? And they invite them to their book clubs. You know, I was just at a book club and these women are like, what can we do to help people like you? And I was like, And so I was like, how many formerly incarcerated women in your book club here? And they were like, oh. I was like, oh, what about in your like church groups, in your community groups? And what about in the schools, your kids' schools? And what about like that you employ or rent to if you own property? And they're like, we don't know. I was like, that's because they're all like, one, there might not be any because you've excluded them. Or two, you just, people are so afraid that people are going to judge them. They don't share their stories, you know? So I think for me, what, you know, I gave this TEDx talk in 2019, which is the only reason I did the book. And the woman who runs it came and said, for 5 years, she's like, can you just tell your story? I was like, absolutely not. Like, I'm keeping a secret. You know, I was very invested in my secret. And she came on the fifth year and said, I'm not leaving your office until you do. And she stayed there 3.5 hours. I was like, okay, I'll do it. So then I had 2 years and I just got up and I said, you know, it was TEDx. It wasn't, you know, a huge, it was a theater. It was a big audience for me. And I just said, you know, here's someone I've been, like, and here's other people I've been, you know, because I was a ghostwriter too, so it just all fit. But I was just like, here's the worst thing I've done, and here's all the other things that make up who I am. And the feeling I had when I did that was better than any drug. I felt light. It has been a constant lightness since that moment. And I chased that feeling, right? And it was just a being like, it is that exhale. It's like, this is just who I am. And this is my story. And it's a big part, but it's not the whole thing. And getting embraced by people and finding out that no one judged me as much as I judged myself, and no one was like unforgiving as I was of myself, like that really helped too. Cause people were like, oh yeah, okay. You know, and I got a community of people who are like, I told that too, because it's so isolating. If you're keeping secrets, I'm never going to be, if I was keeping a secret, we would not have connected deeply at that party, because mm-hmm. I wouldn't want you to know too much about me, because you might know my secret, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, not that you have to tell everyone everything, but you know, like something you're ashamed of like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's really isolating, and that's how it healed. It was just, but it's slow. It's a slow, shame heals slowly. And you have to be constantly vigilant. And even now there'll be little moments where I'll be like, oh, look at that shame pop up. Mm-hmm. Like I'll sign an author to my literary agency who's read my book, or who then's like, oh, I'm going to read your book now. And then I'm like, oh shit, what if they don't want to work with me? And I could literally got an email where they said, I'm more excited than ever to work with you because I read your story. And I still will read that differently. I'll read those words and I'll be like, oh, they might not want to. Like, you know, that's how like sticky it is too. Mm-hmm. It's like it pops up. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm just, you have to be vigilant like anything.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And
that's why it's worse than heroin, because in heroin, you can detox in 3 days and it's out of your system. Shame.
That's right. Mm-mm. It's insidious. It's so deep. It's so subtle. It's so woven into every aspect of your personality, into every aspect of your psychological patterning. My shame was when I look from a psycho-spiritual past life approach, it's something that has been, you know, cooking into my family tree through my grandmother, who ended up killing herself based on the shame that she had from not being able to advocate and take care of her first son, who died of a skin disease when he was 28 years old. And then that shame then was cooked into mom. And then it's been very prevalent in my own life. And it's something that I have had to not overcome, is not the right word, but work with to such mm-hmm. a degree. And I it's funny you talk about your TEDx, because my TEDx was also about It Didn't Start With You. That was the title of it, because it was really speaking about the shame mm-hmm. that I felt. And it was beyond the mistakes I had made. The shame that I felt was not equivalent to the mistakes I had made. I felt this enormous shame that I was such an awful, horrific, bad person. So much so that it didn't match. It wasn't a currency, equal currency to the mistakes I had made. I was like, it doesn't make sense to feel this bad for these mistakes. But I didn't have the wakefulness, the realization, the insights, the somatic realization that this, perhaps it's something that's been passed down. It's something that I have been gifted. Now I see it as a gift, because I'm actually able to empower people, speak to it, help people lift that veil of feeling like they're inherently bad, you know? But just hearing you talk about it.
Yeah, I had something similar. But, you know, my grandmother, my mom's mother, killed herself also.
Oh, fuck.
We're like twins in some ways.
I know. What is happening?
Are you actually my son? You might be my son. It was before I was born, my mom was pregnant with my sister who died. And so, you know, I know that that shut my mom down. You know, again, it was never talked about. And when I did the place Gabor advises for, I did an ayahuasca retreat before I went to write my book. I did it in Costa Rica, and I was like, I'm going to go face my demons so I can write this book. And like the demons I thought I was going to face, none of that came up in the ayahuasca journey. I was like, oh, I actually have already done that work. But what came up was this sort of, goes back to the lightness too. I had this realization. It was like patterns. And I was like, I always thought my base level was kind of sad. Like, that's my story. I was like, my base level is sad, but I'm actually like very immature and silly. And like, that's my base level also. And when I was in the ayahuasca thing, there was just this thing that came to me with the generations of women. And it just like, this voice said, like, this is not your sadness to carry. Like, I heard that, like, this is not your sadness. And I was like, oh shit, it's actually not mine. Like, that is not my base level. That is my mom's sadness. That is her mom's sadness. And you know, I never went back further than that, but that was like so freeing, like physically, you know, like it was just like, oh, Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
And the other thing on ayahuasca, I thought it might be Beyonce also. That happened too.
Well, naturally, darling. I think it's something, this is really edgy and funny what I'm going to say, but a lot of people come out of ayahuasca, they're like, I am from Jesus's lineage. I am Mary Magdalene. I am, you know, Christ's second coming. I'm the second coming, you know? And I'm like, and ayahuasca also gives people these like very big missions, which I find are very creative. The spirit of ayahuasca, no shame in the game. Whatever leads you to liberation, whatever gets you to, if you need to feel like you are the second coming for you to go and do some big, epic, impactful, loving Mother Teresa type shit in the world, by all means, go. And say it and name it and let the God complex live. I have no problem, honey.
But there is a lot of that too. In the, I was like, everyone can't be royal in a past life. Cause what about the commoners? I was a commoner.
Literally everybody comes out of it feeling like I was Cleopatra.
Yeah.
I was the Ark.
Yeah. I think like really for me, her song was playing and it was just like that. I slay. And I think it was like, I need to slay. And I really like after that trip, I ended up not right away, but like over a couple years, like I went and wrote my book. I quit my job of 12 years CEO, started my own agency. I started doing all these. So I hadn't thought of that on the creative mission. I started the nonprofit, but I think that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
You know, in a very subtle ways, but yeah.
Yeah. One thing I want to name about the shame before you get to answer that last question about these, you know, superstars. I write about it in my new book about shame, that you have to have friends that can hang out with you in the plane of secrets. There are certain things, certain aspects of your biography that are meant to be shared far and wide, because that helps you to really unravel the shame narrative that you are innately bad, inherently an awful person. Certain things can be for the public, and some things are meant to be shared for that core five, you know, where they can hang out with you in that plane of secrets, where it's non-dual, where Rumi speaks about, the Sufi poet speaks about that plane of that goes beyond right or wrong, where things are neither bad or good, happy or sad, right or wrong. It's just, they just are. They are neutral, impersonal experiences. And we need friends. And it's beyond a therapist. We need an actual, maybe you are working with your therapist in person, but I say friend because it's someone that can actually help you to co-regulate. You know, when you're telling them this deep, dark secret that for you seems like an awful thing that you've done, they can hear it. And it's important for them that inside of themselves, whoever is listening, there's no ounce of judgment. So it has to be someone who's practiced. It has to be someone who has a degree of realization. It has to be someone who has a degree of somatic wakefulness to be able to just listen without good or bad, happy or sad, right or wrong. So it literally washes over them like anything else. Not because it's not this or that. It's because that is at the core of every experience. We are the ones who are making meaning based on what they are. So having people who can hang out in a plane of secrets with you, it's how your view of something that's bad can be dismantled. And you can actually like rest more easeful into your true self, into your true nature. Yeah. So I just wanted to name that.
Yeah. I have friends, they call a little differently, who just taught me this, that, and supported me in my grief that week, first week with my dad, and just let me do that. And they call it listening with holes. And they've taught me to do this. So because it's really important also, because some of us who have a lot of mama love energy and are helpers by nature, right? So they helped me do this thing. It's called listening with holes. So you do that, you're listening, there's no judgment, but you let it flow through you, the listener too. So you're not carrying it, right? Like that is something I'm having to learn that. Right. Yeah. And so that's a good visual for me. It's like I'm listening, but is this something I'm listening and holding, or I'm listening with holes? It's the same presence and non-judgment in that, but you don't want to. And, you know, when you have so many children, like you can carry a lot of stuff. So sometimes you have to be like, that's my new practice right now.
I love that. Listening with holes. That sounds really skillful.
So it flows through you.
Exactly. Pass it through you, you know? And it does take practice to arrive at this place, you know? Okay, so let's close. But before we close, talk to us about, you've met Oprah, you've meditated with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you've had dinner with Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Like, what the fuck? What have you learned from, you know, what's your most profound takeaway from having met and experienced these people? Because I just want to say for context, one of the main reasons, two reasons why I became a Buddhist. First, because His Holiness the Dalai Lama was the only person who is a religious figure. And I'm drawn to religion. I'm drawn to the occult. I'm drawn to spirituality. Like it is the driving force of my life. He was the only person with religious power to say queer love is love, period. Right. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh shit, that's epic. Because I really wanted to be part of the Hare Krishna movement, but they said, no queer people, bye. And I was like, okay, mm-hmm. Fuck you. I'm going to go find something else. Anyways. So that's one reason. Second reason, I had gone to a talk that he did at the temple in Dharamshala. And I remember being in that courtyard and I was like, what the fuck is happening? Like, I feel high. Like, I feel like my nervous system is so regulated. I'm so relaxed. Did someone spray something in there? I don't remember drinking or smoking anything. I'm like, so I remember then later talking to people and then saying, darling, you're in the presence of a holy being. The holy being has the capacity to impact everyone who's in their auric field, in their space. And everyone is invited into that serenity because they hold such deep serenity within themselves. So just context. So now talk to us about that.
So well, I will tell you with that, when I was, so obviously we spent a week in dialogue with Archbishop Tutu to create the Book of Joy and His Holiness. We were recording it. We had film crews, as you know, and all of this stuff. And they made a little documentary, which I have is my first movie star thing. You can see me, if you don't blink, you can see me in the movie. But
she's talking about Mission Joy, you guys.
Yeah, Mission Joy. Yeah. So
it's a little documentary. I love how it's like a huge documentary.
So huge, amazing. And so but you'll see in there when we're in his private residence, you know, he invited us to join his, you know, the last hour of his 5-hour meditation one morning. And Archbishop Tutu did Eucharist with him. And it was like this really beautiful exchange of spiritual beliefs there, you know, and there's no big audience, just all of us. And, but we joined him in it was a death meditation. Actually, I just remembered that he taught us his death meditation that he did since death is our theme today. Right. So, but I was sitting there and I knew there was cameras in there and we did the meditation. When I was done, Jason was one of the cameramen and I would go, you were looking through the camera with that. I was like, was I by any chance levitating during the meditation? Cause I had that feeling too. I was like, I think I'm like, I didn't know my eyes, but I'm like, I'm pretty sure I'm like this far
off the ground.
I'm pretty sure I'm levitating. Like that's what it felt like. And that's what you're describing too. It was just like this. I didn't think they had sprayed a drug in there, but it was like really like, and with his personal shrine and it was glowing from within and all of the stupas and all the things that people have given the artwork from the palace in the 50s, you know, it was all around us. And it was just like, I was like, oh, I'm lifting up. Like, this is insane. But on the footage in the Mission Joy film, I am firmly on the ground. You can see me sitting cross-legged. But, you know, I wish, like, working with all, you know, all these people on their books where I'm, like, really in their minds and hearing their ideas and their view of the life. Like, I don't know that I have one big takeaway. You know, one is just, like, everybody's people, too. You know, like, everybody's just people. I think with the spiritual leaders, Arch and His Holiness, what struck me most was their joy, like their laughter, the playfulness of their nature, even though they deal with very serious world things. They've been through like way bigger things than I'm going to go through in my lifetime in their stories. And they have such a in the moment joy. That's what I learned that I want. And then probably one of my greatest spiritual teachers of all these people, no offense to the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, is Anthony Ray Hinton, who I did a book with called The Sun Does Shine. And he's an innocent man who spent 30 years on death row in Alabama and came out with zero bitterness, zero lack of forgiveness, zero hatred, and I just couldn't understand that. I'm writing a book as him. That was the Oprah pick. That's who I got to have lunch with Oprah with, is Mr. Hinton and I. And he said to me, Laura, I am not going to give, when he was sentenced, when he was 29, knew he was innocent, sentenced to death row in Alabama, which is the most hellish place on earth. Mm-hmm. And he was like, they can take away everything. They can't take my soul. And when he got out, he's, he's interviews, big media thing. And they're like, well, how are you not bitter? And he's like, I am not giving one more second of my joy to that. Right. Like not one more second. It's like that easy. It was that easy, you know? And wow. He's like, I walk 5 days every day because I can. Like his gratitude instead of bitterness is like the most powerful thing, I think, that I've learned in all of that. Like an example that I go back to, you know, like when the hard shit happens and people do horrible things and hurt you and betray you, like how much life energy are you going to give to that person more, mm-hmm, by like staying in it, ruminating it, and trying to rewrite history and, you know, all those things. So, you can't work on books with people and not take away a little something, something from everyone.
I mean, casual, darling. And what an epic, insane story. Wow. Oh my God. I can't even, yeah. I think, what's his name said something, similar, Nelson Mandela. And I think, these two women, monastic women who were captive, who were in captivity, yeah, by the Chinese government. It runs, there's a theme within these saintly people.
Yeah.
Of like, sure, you can do me wrong in this reality where you have power over me, but my inner reality, my spiritual reality, yeah, fuck you. And not fuck you, but like, yeah, I am sovereign. I am, you know. So yeah. I love this.
And the other theme is just like, you know, this is not new wisdom, but it's just like how profoundly they're in service to other people as a way, which is like Tutu's like, it's actually a very selfish thing to do because you feel so good. Like compassion, altruism, it's actually selfish because that, like, there's your drug. There's your drug of choice, right? Mm-hmm. Like it feels really good. Mm-hmm. And when we were in Dharamsala, I don't say it as well as you do, but when we were there in the dialogues, there was a lot of talk of heaven and hell between Tutu, and you've probably seen the movie, but you know, he's like, I'll go to hell where I can help more people. That's what he's like. If I go to heaven or hell, I think I'd rather go to hell. This is His Holiness saying, because there's more people to help there. You know, like that is the thing.
That level, right? Of altruism, that level of compassion. Yeah. And, you know, people have heard me say this a million times, but what saved me from not taking my own life was caring for other people. It was having, mm-hmm, had a vision from one of my spiritual teachers. And she was like, go be of service. I was like, I have nothing to offer. She's like, think again. And mm-hmm, I went and, you know, the rest
look at
of
you history. Now.
That's right.
That's literally. Right. Look at me now.
Exactly. Look at us now. Guys. Wow. Go get Mama Love's new book, The Many Lives of Mama Love. Go get the book. It's everywhere. And if you are like me and you love an Audible, go listen, because she narrates it and it's fun and delicious. And what an amazing thing to listen. What an inspiring woman you are. Thank you. Thank you for paving the path for this awake life, this vulnerable, honest way of living. And I hope I get to give you a fucking hug in person. I'm so sorry. Life is so shitty right now. And I love you. And thank you.
I was just about to say that. I was like, oh, I would hug you. Okay. Next time. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
What a joy. Thank you. Love you.
Love you.
Did you love this episode as much as I did? I say this about every episode because it's true. I love that I'm actually able to have this conversation and bring them to you all. And listen, if you were moved by this episode, if you were inspired by it, if you feel like it tickled your heart, don't forget to rate and review the podcast. And if you rate and review on Apple or Spotify or both, if you feel inspired, send us a screenshot of your rating and review to operations@sadisimone.com. And that's operations@sadisimone.com with the subject line podcast review. And you will receive my free guide to help you end imposter syndrome. So get into that and enjoy that free guide, because it's profound. It's powerful. It's something that I've used for many years. It's something that I have written about and talked about so much, because it actually freaking works. All right. Love you. Take good care. And also, oh my goodness, forgot. Don't forget to go buy her book. Go buy her book. Literally support this incredible author. Support this incredible woman. The Many Lives of Mama Love. The Many Lives of Mama Love. Go get the book and write a review for the book too. All right. Peace. Love you. Take good care. Okay, I'm calling on all the home bar enthusiasts right now. Are you ready to create a new kind of bar experience? One that's sober and filled with magic? Let's create a bar that goes beyond the ordinary, honey. And let's infuse it with the spirit of adventure, wellness, and connection. And listen, with that in mind, I need to share with you Anima Mundi's Apothecary and their wonderful brand new elixir collection. When I saw that, I was like, honey, we got to share this with the community immediately. Even if you're not interested in becoming fully sober, you're sober curious, you just want to, you know, kind of try something different that's still going to make you feel good and sassy and delicious and be like, ooh, I like this, then this is for you. One of their elixirs that I adore, it's the Euphoria. It's composed of organic, wild-crafted, and ethically grown botanicals. It's like a potion for joy. And trust me when I tell you this, honey, for those of us who are on a sober journey, or if you are in a sober curious journey, you're going to drink this, honey, and you're going to be like, ooh, girl, what's in this shit? But hey, honey, it's just a bunch of amazing, organically grown botanicals mixed together to give you that, ooh, I like this feeling. You know what I mean? And they have this elixir kit, Barista Series. It is gorgeous, iconic, legendary. Buy it for your house, or also buy it for a friend. That got to be a sweet friend, honey, because that's going to require you a little bit of more of an investment. You could also just get each of the elixirs by themselves, right? And it's an invitation for you to become a spiritual mocktail barista in the comfort of your own home. You know, trust me, you're going to love it. Your body is definitely going to love it. Your mind will thank you, and your soul will be like, okay, honey, okay, lit. Listen, and I guarantee you that people that try these elixirs are going to be like, oh, what's going on, honey, over here? I mean, you got to find a recipe that works, but this is the base of it. It's delicious, amazing, and it's going to get you lit. Are you ready to unlock the magic of this elixir collection, honey? Head over to animamundiherbals.com. I'm going to try to spell that for you. animamundiherbals.com. Herbals is spelled herbals.com. Or instead of you listening to spell this, you know, trying to pass the spelling bee over here, go to the link in the show notes. And listen, don't forget to use code capital SAH number 1 and number 5, SAH15 at checkout for an exclusive 15% off your order. Okay. Bless all this beautiful, sober, spiritual bar experiences that you're about to create. Love you.